Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, we're talking to a whole host of actors, Leah Lewis and Mamoudou Athi of the new Pixar Elemental, as well as Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Hayley Atwell, Pom Klementieff, and Vanessa Kirby for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, Part One. And we're rating both of those films as we get towards tentpole season. Very exciting. Awesome. But before we talk about that and we talk to all of them, Matthew, what else have you been watching?
I've also seen another new release that's out this week, Smoking Causes Coughing, from Oscar Depew, who did the film Rubber and various other surreal comedy dramas. And this is kind of his superhero movie, but very, very different from a Marvel or a DC movie. It kind of starts off a bit like a parody of a Power Rangers movie. The team is called Tobacco Force, so you can kind of see this isn't really for kids, this movie. And it's very, very typical of his work. Lots of digressions, lots of surreal, strange happenings going on, totally unpredictable, wild stuff happening from start to finish. I didn't think it all worked, but I did enjoy it a lot. Very much my kind of thing.
Sounds very much not like my kind of thing.
Really, yeah.
It sounds like a make-it-end film to me.
You might find that, yeah. It's very silly, very squishy in parts as well. And it's got this rat who kind of dribbles constantly, who's pretty gross. It's a bit like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles rat. Splinter. Yeah, Splinter. Like that. It's kind of gross, yeah, but I enjoyed it.
Well, speaking of duly squishy and gross, I have finally finished The Idol.
Oh, well done.
I'm a bit late to the party. I was a few days behind everyone else. But that was mostly because I had to rewind the fifth episode to see if I'd accidentally forgotten or missed something, because there was such a huge narrative change and a motivational change in one of the characters that I was like, did I miss an entire episode? What's happened? But no, it's just the mess that it has been from the very start. Is it going to be so bad that it achieves the Room level or Showgirls level of cult status in the future?
That's what you want.
What do we think? I mean, I don't think so. I think it's just, you know, it's so hateful in terms of it hates everyone on screen seems to just despise everything about itself. I've also got nipple and bum fatigue from watching it, which I never thought I'd say.
No.
I feel like I've seen...
pretty excessive.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen as much of Lily Rose Depp's body as any of her paramours. And not saying, you know, it's a very nice body, but you can have too much of that, it turns out. And The Weeknd, I don't know, I feel rather grubby about now. And I loved his music and loved him before this. And it's actually made me listen to his music in a different way, which isn't necessarily a good thing. So, yeah, I found the whole thing fascinating to watch something being created with the point of, like, shocking and outraging, but actually did neither of those things, was just really quite dull. Did you watch any of it?
No, I didn't. I keep hearing about it. Yeah, I mean, it's been a real hot topic, hasn't it? It's gotten so much news coverage and social media coverage. But yeah, I haven't heard anyone actually say they enjoy it or that it's actually that great.
Yeah,
so it just I mean, seemed like it inspired more hate watches than anything else.
I sort of had to finish it because I'd started it. You know, when you start a show and you're like, well, I've done three. I have to get through to the other two. So I did. Yeah. But very disappointing finale in terms of selling out its character, if indeed there was any point to Jocelyn and her character. Who knows? Only they know. Only Sam Levinson knows what was supposed to be achieved with this. But yeah, it wasn't very good.
Is there going to be a second series?
Apparently
is
not.
No, really, it's just a one and done.
I heard that apparently it was supposed to be six episodes and was chopped to five because it was tracking so badly. But and that might explain why there's a sudden massive leap in narrative where you're suddenly like, why is she now behaving like this? There's nothing to indicate this change. Perhaps that's what got lost. I don't know. I'm glad I've seen it because there's been so much discourse about it. And I do think that Lily Rose Depp is talented. I think she was doing something quite interesting within that, but that's not the thing that's going to set her onto a massive upward trajectory. I hope to see her in something else that's more worthy of her talents.
Yeah. Well, right. Is it a step up from the Kevin Smith movies?
I mean, yeah.
Not saying much.
No, it's not. Bless him. I love him. But yeah, it's
better. I love Kevin as well.
Is it better than Yoga Hosers? Well, that's debatable. Maybe Yoga Hosers is better. And that does involve a German sausage Nazi that crawls up your ass and kills you. So,
ooh, that's a bingo.
You know.
Not every film can say that.
Not every film. Shall we see if there are any German sausage Nazis that crawl up asses in the next film, then?
Wunderbar.
It's time to go to Element City with this.
Meet the residents of Element City. Air usually has their head in the clouds.
Oh, my new jacket!
Earth can be a little seedy.
Nothing weird going on here.
Just a little pruning.
Water is always getting into something.
Help!
And fire?
As ordered.
We run a little hot.
So this is Pixar's latest, Elemental. And before we decide whether we're blowing hot or cold on this, here's Molly Edwards discussing a watery, fiery romance with its stars Leah Lewis and Mamoudou Athi.
So you've never left Firetown?
Sorry, buddy. Elements don't mix.
Hey!
Plus, my dad would boil you alive.
Why does anyone get to tell you what you can do in your life? Come on!
I loved the film. So massive congratulations on it. It was so cute. I cried. I loved it. And there is such a sweet love story at the heart between your characters. So I was wondering, like, how did you make sure you could create that chemistry between Ember and Wade? And how do you feel about being part of a Pixar rom-com?
I mean, Mamoudou and I actually were never even in the room together. But I also think, like, Peter was just an incredible director in being able to lead us to those points. But
we love Pete is basically
the answer. Is like, the whole question
the love
and answer.
Of Pete is what combined.
Yes, it's the love of Pete, and also just like for the love of Pete.
For the love of Pete.
But I also think we relate so heavily to these characters, and just the way Peter put his 1,000% in. We equally and separately did the same thing. So I feel like that chemistry you're feeling is just us really relating to the characters and like giving it all we got and then, hoping that it works and it worked.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you feel that we had that chemistry.
The date montage was like so cute. I was like, oh my God.
So good. And the song, Ari Lev, who is Lauv, is so good at what he does.
Both the characters, they have such a unique animation style. And what was your reaction when you saw those designs and also like the look of Element City, which is just stunning?
I became quite close with Sam Neill during the filming of Jurassic World. He's just like the loveliest man. And I sent him a photo of what Wade looked like. And he's like, he looks like how you sound. It really made me, right?
Aww.
Right, that happened to me. I was like, oh, Sam Neill.
Cut the cameras.
And it was really moving to me. My voice is naturally quite low. So I didn't think that anyone would ever cast me as a part like this. And I was really just grateful that Pete saw me for who I feel like I am.
I'm still not over that. when I first saw Ember, I just even the little line drawing that Peter showed me from the beginning, I was like, she's beautiful. And like the way that she moves in the film, the animators have done such a good job of making these characters, like even Wade too, so light on their feet and like the way they move. But I think when I look at the characters, I just feel joy. There's such a purity to both of them. I think Ember has this elegance and this beauty, but you can also see that she's capable of like insane strength. Oof. But when you look at Wade, you're just like, I want that to be my buddy.
Yeah.
And like the way the animators have done it too, to actually make fire and water come alive in something. Like I had no idea what that was going to look like. And you know, in the beginning they were like, sometimes it looked funny or it looked scary. And you know, there is a lot of humor and there are moments when Ember kind of blows up into a firewall, but
so cool.
Yeah, they just did the impossible. Ugh. They made it look realistic while you still also know it's a cartoon, not a cartoon, an animation.
Yeah. Yeah, they did it all.
You're really contemplating that.
No, because I just think like it's hard for me to like really imagine. I've never worked like these animators have worked. I've just never done anything to that level of like dedication
for 7 years.
doing just figuring it out until they get to this moment. It's
so much work. Leia Ember is also part of such a beautiful, like, first and second generation immigrant narrative in this film. So, like, what are your thoughts on being part of telling that story?
I don't take it lightly in the best way. The fact that we're able to tell these real life stories, and also ones that are dangerously underrepresented, who don't always get to speak out, to be able to portray that story and give people a moment where they're like, I'm understood and I see myself. And it's not just, you know, one culture, it's everyone that can kind of watch this who has ever also felt like an outsider. But, you know, God, it's just a privilege. I mean, even Mamadou, though, like, tell your story. I think that's a really big bit. A really big part of the immigrant experience.
Yeah, no, I've been boring everyone with my story. No,
it's not boring.
I became a citizen while we were making this movie of the States. And my parents came from Mauritania. Well, I came with my parents from Mauritania when I was a baby. And my dad was a diplomat. My mom worked in his office as well. And they had to leave everything behind, their documents, paperwork, everything, to start life afresh in the States. And as I get older, I understand more fully and just how deeply moving that sacrifice is, how tragic it is at the same time, but also how hopeful it all is. And just that immigrant experience is something that I think a lot of people can relate to, sacrificing for the next generation or for yourself even. But, you know, I'm so grateful for my parents doing what they did for us. And, you know, this movie is like a thank you to them as well.
1,000%. I mean, this film is also made for that reason, so people can relate to that too, you know? And like, when they can't speak for themselves, like, this film does that. Because these are really tender and difficult things to talk about as well, I feel like.
So that is Leia and Mamadou talking about their characters. One fiery, one watery. Can the two ever meet? Matthew, does this work? Does this gel? Are we in our element with Pixar here?
Does it get steamy? Is that what you're asking? Fire and water together.
Yeah. I mean, it is a romance. Is it steamy?
It is, yeah.
It's still children.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the interesting thing. I mean, well, it's not done very well so far in the States. I mean, it remains to be seen how well it will do. And I feel like they've maybe missold it, because it is Pixar's romantic comedy, which I don't think really came across in the trailers. It felt like the trailers were more sort of selling the concept of this is a city where everyone is one of the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And then at the center of it, you do have, Ember, who's a fire element. And she begins a kind of a love-hate friendship with Wade, who's made of water. So they are very much the sort of central couple. I mean, there are kind of sort of thrillery aspects to it as well, and some adventure, but it is very much a relationship drama. I think maybe they haven't really sold it so well. That's perhaps why it hasn't done as well. I mean, and it doesn't have so much star talent in it as other Pixar movies. Although we should say everybody who's in it is terrific. So perhaps that's why it hasn't kind of played so well. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really good, really touching, really funny. It's got all the kind of classic Pixar touches. The whole environment's been worked out to the nth degree. Tons of Easter eggs. I'm sure, like, if you freeze framed it, you could pick out all kinds of visual and verbal puns. I found the characters very endearing. There was one moment where I had something terrible in my eye that just wouldn't shift. I won't say when this happens in the movie, but yeah, there was one bit that really, really got to me. And it's sort of similar in some ways to Inside Out, because it's kind of like it's personifying these elements in the way that Inside Out had your rage and joy. So you've got here, you've got fire and water. And then it's also similar to Zootropolis, in that it's got this whole entire different universe that kind of operates like a human universe, but where it was animals, here it's elements. But it's different from that again, where Zootropolis was much more of a sort of a buddy movie and a kind of police procedural, whereas this is much more rooted in the relationships. I just thought it was really lovely. I mean, it's beautiful to look at the characters. I mean, it used to be that things like fire and water were real holy grails for CG animation, but they've so nailed it now. It's not sort of too distracting. They've kind of got it to a point where it's beautiful to look at, but you're not kind of distracted by it. You can still focus on the characters and what they're saying and doing and their personalities. So yeah, it really is lovely. It's got a really lovely soundtrack as well. So I feel like going to bat for it, especially as it hasn't done so well. It got a slightly muted response in Cannes as well, and then it hasn't fared so well at the box office. But yeah, I'd like to champion it because I really enjoyed it.
I'm surprised because I have to say I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I was away the day that they showed it, so I didn't get to see it.
Yeah.
But I was a bit underwhelmed by those trailers. It felt very surface, one dimension, and not the sort of rich deepness that you're talking about when you talk about Inside Out, which absolutely killed me. And, you know, when you're talking about Inside Out, that's a very high bar. And Pixar has a very high bar legacy.
That's always the issue, isn't it?
Yeah. So where does this sit in the sort of Pixar canon for you? Is it right up there with an Up and a, you know, an Inside Out, or is it one of the lesser ones?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like, top tier. And it's interesting you mention Up because there's an Up short with the film as well. It plays before it, which is just fantastic. It really kind of is exactly what you want from an up story. But yeah, I would say it's a bit below that, but I certainly wouldn't put it, you know, down with like Cars 3 or Cars 2 even, or some of the other sequels that felt a bit redundant. It is nice to see them still kind of trying to do all these original ideas. They've had like a slew of those recently with things like Soul and Luca. But it feels like they are trying to get a bit more out of their comfort zone and kind of do slightly more mature stories that don't rely on kind of adventures and quests and obvious sort of comedy beats. And it's from the director of The Good Dinosaur, which was also
love that.
Not as well received. But yeah, I love
The Good Dinosaur.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it was very underrated. I certainly enjoyed it as much as that. So I would certainly recommend it, you know, especially to anyone who does enjoy a good Pixar movie. Maybe the younger, maybe little ones might get a little bit restless with some of the more sort of talky relationship stuff and the kind of delving into family dynamics and family history. But there's lots of chases as well and silly bits to kind of keep people amused.
And it's also Pete Son, who directed this, has also talked about how it's sort of a love letter to his own family and his immigrant experience, because this is very much about, you know, elements feeling out of place within certain parts of the city.
Yeah.
Does that come across? Is that sort of strongly leaned into as well?
Yeah, oh, totally. Yeah, you really kind of get that. I mean, I have seen some people argue that it didn't really need to be a story about fire and water. It could have been just a story about humans. But obviously the whole element thing does give it a kind of a novelty, and it's fun to see them play with that. But it still kind of keeps, you know, it stays grounded. And yeah, you can really see where he's been inspired by his own family history. And there's like a very touching dedication at the end. You can see where he's really drawing on that, in the same way that like Turning Red was kind of rooted in a specific experience as well, while obviously being quite a heightened expression of that experience. I mean, I wouldn't sort of put it on a par with Turning Red, but it is kind of in a similar ballpark.
And it's quite nice, I suppose, to see films that aren't just purely for kids. I mean, Pixar has always worked on a sort of multi-level way that, you know, there's something for adults to get out of it as well. But do you think this is tipping that balance a little bit more in favor of the adults than it has done before?
Yeah, perhaps so. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, I took my 9-year-old son to see it, and he liked it, but he wasn't kind of wowed by it, you know, as much as something like Across the Spider-Verse. So I mean, he hasn't sort of talked about it much, so yeah, maybe it will sort of play better to an older audience, you know, animation fans.
And meanwhile, Daddy had a tear in his eye and was snuffling in his popcorn. So if you fancy a go on Elemental, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Worth seeing on a big screen?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, for the visuals and the soundtrack, absolutely.
Okay, should we move on then, because we have a lot more chats to get through. It's time to choose to accept this mission.
The world's coming after you.
Who is that person?
I have no idea.
Looks like we lost them.
You've no idea the power I represent. It knows your story. And how it ends. His fate is written. Shall we write yours too?
Ethan, what's your objective?
none of our lives can matter more than this mission.
I don't accept that.
So this is Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, dash, part one, where Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt is tested to the limit by a new foe and much twisty-turny double-crossing. Before we get into whether TC's superhuman action efforts have paid off, let's listen to his co-stars talk about their project. Our very own Bradley Russell sat down with Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Hayley Atwell, Tom Clementieff, and Vanessa Kirby last week, and here's what they nattered about.
Ethan, listen to me. You need to pick a side. Stay out of my way.
What is something new you discovered about Benji and Ilsa in Dead Reckoning? Because, I don't know, like, you must always sort of peel back those layers and discover something new about them in each film.
I guess you try and build on what's gone before, really. You think about what they've been through. Ilsa and Benji, actually, they had a, you know, she saved his life. And they had this incredible moment at the end of Fallout when they, you know, defused that bomb together. I think going forward, you know, their relationship, the closeness of the group intensifies each time. And you just try and play on what's gone before, don't you? It's quite a privilege as an actor to have that to do.
Mission Impossible obviously used to be sort of, it used to be characterised by, you know, like directors coming in and putting their own stamp on the franchise. Correct. But like, yeah. Christopher McQuarrie, what is having that through line of him being in, obviously directing four films now, what does that do?
Well, it lends itself to a greater sort of continuity.
Do you know the other directors?
I know JJ and I know Brad Bird.
Yeah.
What it creates is a sort of a consistency. What they used to thrive on their difference, you know, it used to be like self-contained little adventures. Now it's more of a kind of continuum. And so you get
they
more of
the
a...
They found the formula, right?
Yeah, together. They've got... Yeah, it is a... It's a, the formula is Tom Cruise plus Chris McQuarrie.
Yeah, them and, together, yeah. Mold together.
And he plays on that. He builds on it. He likes to... He believes in the legacy of the film, the whole series, you know.
And there's a security for us as well, because we know how it works. We understand. It doesn't change.
We know they know the characters well enough to write for us.
Obviously, Ilsa and Ethan's relationship does, like, develop a little bit more in this movie. How important are those quieter moments surrounding the action and the bomb burst?
I think the quiet moments are always interesting. And I think in a film like this, something that people don't know or we don't talk a lot about with Tom is we know about the action and we know we train, but his curiosity and all of our curiosity for characters' weakness or vulnerability or fear or we constantly on set when we discuss scenes is the why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. But how did I feel? But how do we link that together? You know, it's an emotional, creative process.
Ilsa as well obviously uses a sniper early on in the movie. And it's in Mission Impossible's DNA for, even if it doesn't look real, it has to look real. What was your training like?
Know. How do you know we're not really secret agents?
There were six people in front of that gun. Were there? None left. we have to. We did. I mean, I don't know if I can mention we go to places. I was going to say Bear Grylls.
Is he in this?
No.
I like him.
Yeah, exactly. Sequence. And here he is.
I was jealous when you went for your weapons training.
I was doing all of my weapons training. And I love the weapons training.
Gabriel comes in as like a real strong force in this movie. Like, how does he compare to sort of the other villains? He's not like a Solomon Lane. He's not like a John Locke. How does he affect your characters in different ways, like push them in different directions?
Well, he's a kind of emissary for something else. I mean, this is the great thing about this film and the subsequent film is that it's an antagonist we've never faced before. And what Isai represents as Gabriel is this kind of this human kind of emissary for this inhuman force. And as such, he wields more power than any before. And Isai is amazing. I mean, he's so effing handsome.
He's so good. I also love his just little... He always has like a little...
He's like he knows how powerful he is,
and how much a part he is of the grander entity than is one single-handed man or woman.
Yeah, he has
and
the
that's
most
so scary for us.
This film is so prescient as well because AI algorithms. Like, can you speak to sort of I guess how it sort of captures this zeitgeist, like our sort of moment in the world?
Almost accidentally, in that when we started the film,
or is it?
McHugh kind of, when he pitched the idea, I thought it felt very Mission Impossible. It felt almost a little sci-fi, but in keeping with our sort of gadget-related kind of...
You said that so well before.
Thank you.
Masks and...
Oh, yeah, it's because the IMF is all about subterfuge, it's about illusion, masks, setting up situations that aren't real to capture enemies, and suddenly they've come up against this thing, and that's all it does, is what the IMF does, but it's everywhere. And it's become prescient in these 3 years. Now it's on everyone's lips. Back in 2019, less so, you know.
You are a master of ticking clock acting, I'd call it.
Thank you.
Ticking clock acting.
Did you hear that, master?
Oh.
And Rebecca and I had to defuse a nuclear bomb at the end of Fallout. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning. The crew were really tired. We were edging into overtime. It was cold. That tension off screen
is brought in.
Like, and in this film, when I was, you know, no spoilers, but Benji comes up against a device. And I remember it being, the feeling on set was like, we've got to get this done. It's got to happen. And it just, McHugh likes there to be, you know, a kind of
pressure outside as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so I am genuinely just that stressed.
These films keep going up and up and up and up. Like, in terms of scope and scale, like, how does this compare to the other Mission Impossibles? But also, like, you've got the part two to come. Was that in the back of your mind?
Well, I think you can only ever be in the moment on these films, can't you?
That's the thing. I mean, the answer to the question is, what we are doing is the biggest at the moment because it is what we're doing. It's very centralised to the sort of the episode.
It did feel different, though. It felt, not just because we were making it when we made it, but it just felt like, you know, Tom and McHugh are never going to just rest on what they've done before.
No.
They're going to push it forward. And every film, when it ends, we get asked what's next. And we think, well, what could we possibly do?
That's what we talk about behind the scenes when we sit there playing backgammon.
Yeah, it's like, what are they going to do now? And they always do.
Hi, Hayley. Welcome to Mission Impossible. So you play Grace. How does she come in and shake up what is already an established dynamic with, you know, Ethan, Luther, Benji?
She's an outsider. She is a lone wolf. She describes herself as strictly singular, which means when she takes jobs as a thief, she doesn't really know who the job is for. She doesn't care. She's very much sort of out for herself. She lives in a kind of a hyper-vigilant survival state a lot of the time. And so it's sort of by accident and it's kind of a botched job that she finds herself opposite someone like Ethan Hunt, who she has absolutely no concept of who he is or what this world is. So in some ways, she's the audience. You know, the audience, if they're coming into this world, they too would be like, what have I got myself involved in here? Okay, how do I navigate this space? So in some ways, we're seeing this world through her perspective.
And you mentioned she's a thief. She's almost like an Artful Dodger sort of character. How did you sort of prepare for that sort of subtle physicality? Was there any, like, I don't know, like any sort of sleight of hand training involved? How did you sort of embody that sort of character?
Yeah, Artful Dodger was absolutely one of the references that we used. Agent of Chaos, Artful Dodger. She's sort of Grace under fire. The physicality, we did 5 months of training before principal photography began. And as well as the fight choreography and a lot of the drifting that I did with Wade Eastwood, we looked at sleight of hand tricks, but also looking at the dancer's body. So, like as you said, there's a kind of a dance between Ethan and Grace, particularly in the car sequence, and when she gets out of the car and they're handcuffed, so they have to kind of maneuver around each other. A lot of that was kind of Pilates-based training. So everything was about sort of making the fights look as elegant as possible. At the same time, though, I wanted to feel that she was a little bit scrappy, that she had not really had any formal fight training, but she was an opportunist. So she'd kind of, as she went along in her life, she'd learnt on the job. So we didn't want to make it look too competent or too perfect.
Even though you had all this prep, all this training, what stood out for you as probably the most difficult scene or sequence for you to film?
I think it would be pretty obvious when I say it's the train sequence. just the size and scale of it for me and for the length of time it's in the film. That was, you know, months and months and months and months. And then we came back to it, I think, a year later to do pickup shots. And I saw it on the call sheet, like, a year later of, like, we owe a couple of shots from it. I was like, oh, my, okay. Okay, here we go. Because each carriage obviously has its own design and its own function within the story, so its own obstacles, whether it's the kitchen, the dining room, the piano bar. And there's so much of it, of course, that didn't make the movie because we shot so much story. You know, I do the splits in the carriage car at one point. You know, I climb onto the kind of roof of it while there's a sea of chairs going underneath me. There's so much that we shot because we wanted to kind of get this feeling that this was a runaway train that was just going to hold us in its grip the whole time. We just spent so much time making sure that the choreography for it was in keeping with the engineering and the mechanics and the practicalities of how that train would actually work falling off a ravine.
You mentioned Grace is very much a lone wolf. There is that moment where obviously she first comes into contact with Ethan's orbit. How does he change her, do you feel? Because, I don't know, there's a sort of, like, a flirty undercurrent there at the beginning, and
I think with Grace, you know, she's, as he kind of, he outs her very quickly in the courthouse scene where he shows her file and says, I know everything about you. I think what's clear in that moment is he knows all the tactics that she would use to get what she wants and needs and how she's able to adapt and be a chameleon in any kind of environment. Flirtation is like the most obvious one that she can use at the beginning. It's when she bumps into him, when she sees that guy on the plane. She uses it as a tactic. So it never runs solely on an authentic romantic agenda between them. I think the thing that he changes in her, you know, she really enjoys her job. She loves the life that comes with it. She's not responsible for anything or anyone else. And I think there is that also comes out of a trauma, a past trauma, and a need to survive and a belief that she can't actually trust people. They're either going to betray her, she's going to accidentally betray them, or it means if she cares about someone, there's a fear of losing them. And I think what you see with the relationship as it evolves is her kind of understanding what actual friendship is and the meaning of connection with someone else and living for something bigger than oneself. So that's where the emotional change starts to become for her.
Forgive me if I'm wrong with this one. I did read an interview with Chris McQuarrie where he said, like, you were on set for production for 100 days before shooting or recording a full dialogue scene. What was that like?
I mean, I come from theatre, and as you can hear from this interview, I talk a lot. I'm so used to language, and language has always been sort of the first tool that I learned from drama school and understanding the classics and plays, and it's all about serving the writer. The writer is kind of God in the theatre, first and foremost, and then it's the director. So coming into a franchise like this and spending 100 days purely about physical behaviour and gesture, I felt like, am I expressing enough? Because I'm so used to being vocal as my main thing. And then what was clear, you'd look on playback and it just felt alive. And I think the physical presence had come from the chemistry that I'd found with Tom, the preparation that I was doing with this incredible world-class stunt team. So you feel her energy, you feel her emotion with her actually not having to say anything. And then also partly because the whole process was this kind of extraordinary traveling circus of around the world. The whole process of how they film is demystified because Tom and McHugh are so inclusive. Anyone who comes onto that set is to welcome to watch playback, watch the monitor. Tom and McHugh will explain something technically that's going on or how this piece of technology didn't exist a couple of years ago and what they found that brings to the lens or to the frame or to the composition. So there is this sense that you're part of this kind of a workshop or a masterclass in pure cinematic experience and how they create it. So that, to me, in between takes, that's where I did all my talking and all my questions. And then for the camera, I found this kind of new language that was not just having to be vocal.
The White Widow is like a character who's like so tricky to get a read on. So I kind of wanted to know, going into Dead Reckoning, how has she sort of been changed by the events of Fallout, the previous film?
Well, yes. Well, obviously, on Fallout, I ended up doing loads of research about arms dealings and what kind of people deal plutonium casually. And also, how do you keep not just governments happy, but mobs and different underground networks? And also the sort of the legacy of the sort of European gypsy underground. When Chris McQuarrie and I were discussing, it felt like where her family originated from to be able to do this kind of work. And so I was wearing bare feet in the first one, although you couldn't tell. They did do a shot of my feet. They probably realised they weren't nice enough to feature in the movie on a massive cinema. But anyway, and Vanessa Redgrave being the big inspiration, obviously being my mother, and so I just got to study her performance and how she so delicately kind of deals in all this really heavy stuff but does it so lightly. But then I thought after 3 years and the time since and kind of being the sole operator of that kind of network, I just thought you couldn't not be stressed and affected by that, you know. I was like, where's the romance in her life? I couldn't tell, so I wanted her to seem a little bit more stressed and a little bit more unhinged slightly.
And Pom, Paris comes into this as almost like a chaotic force of nature. How does she shake up what is, at the beginning of the movie, a pretty established dynamic?
I mean, she's like a force of like destruction. It was really fun to play. And I think she brings something that is a little bit like punk, like even in the way she dresses, you know, and the way she behaves, you know. She follows her own rules. She's a rebel, and she's quite lonely too, you know. So it's kind of like this, you know, like character that doesn't speak much. She doesn't need to. She's like a little bit like a cowboy, you know, like riding and just killing people.
I do want to talk about your character's look. Like, did you contribute to it? Because that sort of visual language is what we sort of understand about your character very early on. So I wondered, did you put your own sort of take on it, your own spin, your flair?
Yeah, totally. Mm. You know, for the way she dressed, also I wanted to be able to do high kicks. So we went for like sometimes skirt, you know, to be able to really go super high. And also for the makeup, you know, there's like, you saw it on the poster, you know, it's like white with a teardrop. It was my idea, you know, I thought that it would be cool to, instead of like wearing a mask, because we're supposed to be in Venice, and at some point all the characters were supposed to go to a party and wear a mask. I thought that it would be cool to draw a mask on my face. And I actually did that years ago. I was invited to a party last minute and they said, oh, it's a masked ball. And I said, oh, I'm going to draw a mask on my face. So I drew a mask on my face. So I thought that the character would do the same thing. And I thought that would be fun to get a look that is a little bit eerie, like a little bit like a pantomime, a little bit like Pierrot Lunaire, you know, this character from the Commedia dell'arte, and with a little teardrop that makes me look like maybe a thug, or like bring some melancholy to the character. And then in the fight scene, you know, with all the effort and all the action and all the sweat, the mask is slowly like falling down and being like disgusting, and I look like a monster, and it was kind of cool actually.
Well, you mentioned those fight scenes as well, because you have some very unique ones, because you have a couple of like very cramped and tight fight scenes. Yes. So like, can you talk us through like how the fight team and the director sort of guided you through that, because that isn't sort of your everyday sort of stunt choreography.
I mean, both fights, there's like the fight in the train, on the train, and the fight with Thomas, on the very tight alleyway. So it's very technical, and you have to use like maybe like height instead of width, you know? So that's why on the train I do like a high kick, and you know, it was like really fun to do that, because also it's super hard, you know?
And Vanessa as well, with the arrival of Gabriel in this, he's a very different sort of proposition and threat to, say, a Solomon Lane or a John Lark. So how does he affect your character?
Yeah, I think I remember that scene when we were all in the club, and there was all these, you know, the big players of the movie, and Pom was there on my left looking so, you know, vivid and scary and potent, just standing there with an amazing sword. The most threatening, I would say. And then Hayley on my right, and then Isai came and sat down and gave this speech about the entity, and I remember us all just focusing on him. Do you remember he had that big long speech? Really hard to remember. And I remember thinking, oh, this is really interesting, because he is a villain, but he is working on behalf of the bigger villain, which is obviously AI. Or an intelligence that we don't, you know, yet understand. It's consciousness. And that was a threat which I think bizarrely unified everybody in that room, you know, because it wasn't just one person. It wasn't just Isai as the face of it somehow. It was affecting him as well. So it was a really interesting concept. And we were all learning about it for the first time at the same time together.
Now, obviously, Paris doesn't say much, like, throughout the movie. But like, as an actor, you must enjoy that challenge of, you know, like, you don't have those lines on the page. So how did you approach that?
I mean, I loved it because, you know, it's such a different way of expressing yourself, and expressing yourself through your movements and through, you know, just your eyes, you know. You know, and I was getting inspired by characters played by people like Clint Eastwood, by Takashi Kitano. And I remember reading this book that Tarantino wrote, you know, the last book that he wrote about Hollywood, where he speaks about Steve McQueen, you know, and that in the movie Bullet, for example, he would like rip off pages of dialogue, and he wanted to speak less and less and less and be more about behavior. And he would say something like, I won't speak, I will just be here peeling an apple. And, you know, it was like, oh, that's cool.
So that's the gang talking about Mission Impossible and all of the various twisty-turny bits that they can't obviously spoil. No. Matthew, for those of us who may not know where we are in the Mission Impossible world, where do we find Ethan Hunt in this film?
You won't be surprised to find he's gone a bit rogue again. I mean, when is he never not rogue? Is there ever a time when he hasn't been rogue?
Him and his never team? Understood how to follow a rule, has he?
No, I mean, they make a joke of that, really, like near the start when he's kind of bantering with Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames, who are, as ever, his main colleagues, kind of bantering that they're always on the run, they're always committing, on the verge of committing treason. So he's kind of in the same situation as always. And the impossible mission he's facing this time is maybe slightly different from before, because the foe he's up against is artificial intelligence this time.
Again?
Another
film with artificial intelligence.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, kind of very well timed, really, even though, I mean, this is obviously filmed a few years ago and delayed because of COVID, but it feels incredibly timely to be coming out now. But yeah, he's up against this mysterious artificial intelligence that's become sentient, called the Entity, which can know everything, can follow everyone, can erase people digitally, can kind of do anything. But there's a key to accessing it, and everybody's after this key, which comes in two parts. So it's a sort of similar MacGuffin to Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, in a strange sort of coincidence.
But
so
isn't going to take anyone back to ancient Greece, I hope.
No, it remains to be seen in part two what actually will happen. But
maybe Dead Reckoning is where Tom and the guys end up in like the Napoleonic Wars or something. Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, all bets are off.
I mean, anything could happen. We have a very sort of quite long and tense pre-title sequence, don't we, with a Russian sub that doesn't even feature TC at all. We don't even get to him until quite a while into this. And then when we get him, we get plenty of him, don't we? Plenty of Tom running in his classic fashion. If you love a Tom Cruise run, you're going to get this on the rooftop of Abu Dhabi Airport. You're getting this on trains. You're getting it getting this through Venice. Getting this everywhere, aren't you?
Through
a candlelit hallway of the Doge's Palace in Venice. I mean, the guy is running.
I particularly enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But apart from that, he's doing some other pretty impressive feats, as we know. We all got the featurette when Top Gun Maverick came out last year, of Tom riding a bike off a cliff and skydiving down to the base of it. What else do we get in this, Matthew? What are the stunts that we are going to get poked in our eyes?
There's lots of driving stunts. I mean, there's all sorts of weird parallels to other summer movies. Starts off with a horse chase in the desert, like John Wick.
Yeah.
There's cars in Italy bumping down steps, like Fast X. There's a small yellow car, like in Transformers. You've got Pom Klimontiev from Guardian. So it's kind of like it's like AI has had a hand in this and kind of mixed in lots of different summer blockbusters and put them all together. But yes, Tom's very much in the thick of all this, getting really into sort of hand-to-hand combat, driving, like you said, motorbike riding, leaping off things, and all kind of in camera. You can tell it's him who's doing this most of the time. Some dangling, some absolutely terrific dangling from time to time.
That's you can put that on a bus. Terrific dangling, Matthew.
Terrific dangling.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the similarity to other movies. There is a train fight and sequence in this on the Orient Express that recalls the Indiana Jones one that we see in the beginning of Dial of Destiny. And that's what makes this much more successful. What you mentioned there, that this is in camera. You can see, as we know, this is Tom Cruise doing it for real, and Hayley Atwell, who we'll talk about in a minute as a hugely impressive addition to this film. But that's what was sort of missing from the Indiana Jones verve, I think, was that weird face mapping and de-aging and uncanny valley of it made it feel not perilous, not remotely real. Whereas this, my goodness, there's a sequence with a train and a bridge, and each carriage doing something one after the other in a domino effect. I was literally like grinding my teeth. It, like, oh God, it was so good, so well executed, so sort of kinetic and balletic and brilliant. It's worth the entrance fee alone for that sequence. So yes, I loved it. Let's talk about, though, not just the action, because that is something that is what they're famous for and what we come to expect. Yeah. And we kind of know that it's going to be great if it's a mission film, that the action's going to be taken care of. Let's talk about story, drama, plot, motivation, characterization. This is a two-parter, so it has to set us up emotionally for a second film next year. Do you think it achieves that with the story and the motivation of Ethan Hunt in this film?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it works. Definitely works as a standalone. Yeah, there's certainly enough spectacle and drama here for it to be satisfying. But it does leave a few big dangling questions to be answered about the nature of this entity. There's kind of a mystery at the heart of this that's going to be answered in the next part. So it does. Yeah, it works on both levels. It kind of satisfies. You feel like you've got, you know, your money's worth, but also you're looking forward to the next one to see how this is all going to play out. Especially as they're kind of talking about this as the next one as being perhaps the end of the current iteration of the franchise.
Is it though?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to take those claims with a pinch of salt, and we've seen Crew seemingly fit to go on forever. But I guess that it will be an ending of sorts next year. And yeah, I thought it sets it up really nicely, because yeah, I found maybe across the Spider-Verse, the way that ended, that was a slightly clunky way of doing a cliffhanger, where it felt like it was just kind of laboring to get all the chess pieces in place for the next one. Whereas this just feels like it really kind of focuses on the peril at hand and resolves all that before moving on to this cliffhanger. Yeah, I thought it was very successful.
It's quite successful as well at, you know, making this about the relationships in this team,
yeah,
and what it means to be loyal, what it means to love, what it means to be in a team like this. The idea that people are handpicked who probably have nowhere else to go, who are backed into a corner and have a specific set of skills that can be useful. So they are offered a mission, and if they choose to accept it, what that actually means for them, that they can never really be normal people again. They can never form relationships and hope to grow old together. There is real peril and a death in this that is quite moving, that also gives another character a real motivational push. There's also the idea that it has to evolve, and like anything, franchise as well as this particular team, it needs to evolve and get new members. So we have the arrival of Hayley Atwell as this amazing pickpocket, and sort of so sort of self-assured, goes toe to toe with Cruz and is absolutely fine, isn't sort of a damsel in distress, isn't wearing skirts and heels, is doing as much as he's doing, and doing dangling being the operative word for this review, isn't it really? And I thought she was so great. Obviously, we've got Rebecca Ferguson and Vanessa Kirby returning. We also have Pom, as you mentioned, turning up as this sort of psychotic henchwoman, which was quite, I liked seeing her play this, when you're so used to the sweetness, kindness and glass half full of her Guardian's character.
Yeah.
To see her play someone who's just ruthless and takes pleasure in pain and destruction, very enjoyable as well. And of course, you've got the ripping off of faces, the classic face mask stuff that we all want to see. But yeah, I think where it leaves this, not only sort of in terms of plot, actual sort of plot line is good, but also in terms of emotional place we left, I really want to see more. I feel closer to this team. I feel like I care more about this team. I think that they've done really well in making me see them as humans and flawed humans that I'm not sure they've achieved before. They were cocky, clever, you know, anything can happen, but you know, we'll take care of it. But in this one, I feel each member gets a moment of clarity and a moment of I can fail and I possibly might, that I thought was just really, really satisfying.
Yeah, you get the sense that the stakes are higher this time, and that's always the thing, isn't it, for franchise movies. They've got to convince you that this time it's more personal, it's bigger, or there's more at stake, and they do that here. Certainly we have to count the personal cost to these characters as well. They address that sense that the people they're helping don't know that they're being helped, that they'll kind of be anonymous heroes if they do save the day and rescue people, because of how they live. They live in the shadows, as they say. So there's something quite poignant about that we will never necessarily know that they've saved our lives. So I like those little touches. I feel like they give it a bit more humanity alongside all the fireworks on top of that.
Yeah. Speaking of fireworks, what was your, without giving any spoilers away, what was your favourite sequence in this?
I do love the motorbike jump. I mean, I have seen it several times now in the featurettes and trailers, but I think it still works here because you get the context. And there's quite a lot of humour before it as well that precedes it. I thought that kind of set it off nicely. And yeah, my stomach did drop when he does do that jump. And then you get to see what happens afterwards. But yeah, the whole train sequence, I thought was fantastic. I did find in the second half, I did find it started to drag a bit in places and got a bit talky, as they often do, you know, with lots of sort of haggling and bartering, and I'm working for this side, no, I'm working for that side, if I do this, you do this, that kind of thing. But I think it really, really picks it up again, and yeah, just ends on an absolute high. I mean, that last half an hour or so, I thought was terrific.
Yeah. I have to say, I loved the aforementioned tiny yellow car. And yeah, speaking of humour, that there is a great deal of humour injected into some of these sequences. Mm. So, you know, Cruz walking up to beep a car that he's been left, and he's thinking it's the delightful grey supercar that's parked up, and this little yellow thing comes out and it makes this ridiculous noise. It's great to see him playing humor and doing that stuff that we love about him, but he's actually doing all that as well for real. He's doing like this chase through Rome, as you said, one-handed. He's driving that car with one hand, because, you know, like, why would you get a stuntman to do that, or why would you put it on the top of a rig? Just do it, you're Tom Cruise. So he learned to drive one-handed, because that's what he does. Yeah, and the speed flying, which you mentioned, when you are not just skydiving, you're speed flying, so you're reaching speeds of sort of 50, 60 miles an hour as you glide very close to rocks and moving objects and stuff. It's really hairy, and that sort of the sense of your heart in your mouth is palpable. It's really well done, I have to say.
Yeah.
If Tom Cruise wants to bring people back in the cinema and he thinks he's the savior of cinema, I have no problem with giving him that title.
No, oh no, absolutely, yeah. I mean, he did it last year with Top Gun Maverick, and he's still on it again. He's obviously got a great relationship with Christopher McQuarrie. They obviously get each other really well. They've kind of worked together like a very well-oiled machine. So long may they continue.
Yeah, we'll wait to see what comes in Dead Reckoning Part 2. Will it be to the center of the earth, to the core? I mean, well, who knows where they'll go with it?
But yeah, I just hope TC just carries on doing what he does.
And running.
More tiny cars, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, more humour.
Car this time.
Yeah, that's what it was like. And it was like, the noise it made me laugh. I loved it. Yeah. I had a big grin on my face.
I thought that was a bit Roger Moore, that whole sequence. I mean, I mean that's a compliment.
It did have a whiff of driving a gondola around a square. Do you know what they should have done? Here's a tip, TC, for next time. They should have had that man who drank red wine in the Roger Moore ones, just like looking at his bottle of wine as that little yellow car went past. That they should do that as a little hat tip.
Little thing.
Yeah. And also, you know, Barbara Broccoli, take note, because, you know, this is as tense as, you know, the Bond finale for me. It does all of the things that was happening in Bond. So the action stakes are definitely heightened. If you fancy a bit of the action, then Mission Impossible No. 7 is out in cinemas now. And it's available on an IMAX big screen. And frankly, I saw it on a big screen, and I think that is the best way to see it, because when people are dangling, word of the week, then it feels tremendously dangerous when you see it on a huge, huge screen. So get the biggest screen as you can and the biggest sound system and enjoy. Right, that is all we have time for this week. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life so much easier by subscribing, and then it just falls into your ears whenever we're available. Next week, we're going to be like Ross and Rachel. We're on a break, but we'll be back on the 20th of July with reviews of Barbie, Oppenheimer, and My Name is Alfred Hitchcock. What a lineup. Join us then. But before we go, we have time for a listener's question. What is a classic or cult movie that people love and you, well, really don't?
Well, it's funny, because I was thinking about this last when I was watching Mission, because it's got Cary Elwes in it, who has a small but significant role. I've only ever seen it once, but I have to say I just didn't get The Princess Bride. I know people love it. I love Rob Reiner's other movies. I love Andre the Giant, but it just didn't work for me. I'd be willing to give it another go, but yeah, I couldn't see what the fuss was about, I'm afraid.
I am equally the same about the one that everybody voted for as the sight and sound greatest film of all time of 2022, which was the Jean Dielman, 23, Quai de Commerce. I think that's how we say it.
I think so.
Which is just a woman chopping stuff up in a kitchen and wandering about, and it's so boring. And I know, I'm being Philistine, and people are like, but that's the point. Hey, Jane, that's the
film
point.
Of all time.
You know, it's the point. It's about like how dull a woman's life is, and it's a really, you know, amazing look at a woman's ordinary woman. And like, I don't want to see an ordinary woman chopping stuff.
Hayley Atwell.
I want to see Hayley Atwell doing close magic and wearing the hell out of a three-piece suit. That's what I want. So yes, that would be my one. I know, I'm a Philistine. There we go. We're both.
I still haven't seen it. I'm afraid. I keep meaning to, but
Matthew, if you're having trouble sleeping, by all means, watch it.
Whack it on.
Yeah. On that note, shall we depart and we will say our goodbyes? I don't know how to do it in the style. Do you want to do it in the style of an Element or in the style of Tom Cruise?
I think Tom Cruise.
Do it.
He'd be like kind of dangling out of an exploding okay. bomb.
So do we need to,
I need a wind effect or something.
Right. Okay. So you're dangling off, I think maybe the bottom of a helicopter.
Yeah.
And as you're buffeted away by the downdraft and everything else, and the camera pans away and we realise how far up you are, you say...
something like, see you at the movies!
There we go. And it's goodbye from me. I'll just do it in the style of Hayley Atwell, which is goodbye. She's very goodbye. Cool, calm. Goodbye.
Thank you.